from Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world. This is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's special edition of the programme, I'm joined by FSN's Russia correspondents, alongside a Washington-based expert on US-Russia relations, as we take a look at the year's top stories from the region. We'll look at Russia's role in the Syria conflict and the removal and destruction of Bashar Assad's chemical weapons.
And I want to thank President Putin for his willingness to pick up on the possibility of negotiating an end to Syrian weapons of mass destruction.
The temporary asylum Moscow handed to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, much to the anger of the US government. And we examine Russia's gay propaganda law ahead of the 2014 Sochi Winter Games. That's coming up on our special edition of FSN Reports, after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Malcolm Brown. There have been strong reactions to a visit by Japan's Prime Minister to a controversial shrine honouring the country's war dead. Shinzo Abe became the first serving Prime Minister in 7 years to visit the Yasukuni Shrine. China and South Korea both issued strong statements of condemnation. The US, a Japanese ally, is expressing disappointment and warning that the visit will exacerbate tensions in the region. An American captured over 2 years ago by Al-Qaeda has appeared in a new video appealing for Washington to negotiate his release. Warren Weinstein was working as a contractor for the US government when he was kidnapped in Pakistan back in 2011. Bearded and wearing a grey tracksuit, the aging prisoner said that captivity had taken its toll.
9 years ago, I came to Pakistan to help my government. And I did so at a time when most Americans would not come here. And now, when I need my government, it seems that I have been totally abandoned.
Yasser Arafat died of natural causes and not poisoning, according to Russian experts. The findings run counter to those of a Swiss lab, which provided some backing for the theory that the late Palestinian leader was killed using the deadly radioactive element polonium-210. The government of Pakistan is condemning an alleged US drone strike carried out in North Waziristan, which killed 4 people, according to local press reports. It's the first strike there in nearly a month. And there's fresh confusion, or new opportunity, depending on your perspective, for Americans trying to sign up for healthcare insurance. Facing political backlash for the rocky rollout of his signature plan, President Obama has authorized yet another deadline delay. From Washington, D.C., Alice Olstein has more.
This Monday was supposed to be the final deadline for registering for a 2014 health plan under the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. But on Christmas Eve, the Obama administration said those who have been stymied by heavy web traffic, periodic website shutdowns, and other issues with healthcare.gov can call in and petition for an extension. This special enrollment period is just one more in a series of last-minute changes and delays. Despite concerns that many may not get the insurance they need by the January 1st launch date, the administration is optimistic. They reported that a record-breaking 2 million people visited healthcare.gov on Monday, with an additional 250,000 calling in. But the White House has not announced how many have successfully signed up for coverage nationwide. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. An ice storm continues to affect the northeastern United States and parts of Canada, where thousands of people remain without power. Crews are working to restore electricity, but are warning that may not happen before Saturday. Nina Maria Potts reports.
At least 27 deaths in the region have been linked to the ice storm, most caused by apparent carbon monoxide poisoning with people using gas generators, after homes and businesses in parts of the central and northeastern United States and Canada were thrown into darkness. Many are still without power. The entire region is under a cold alert, with temperatures still below freezing. Some U.S. states kept emergency shelters open for people without power. In Canada, tens of thousands of people have been warned they may not have electricity restored to them until Saturday, while meteorologists are warning the extreme weather could last a few days yet. Nina Maria Potts, Washington.
Meanwhile, delivery companies in the U.S. are playing catch-up. Shipping giants UPS and Federal Express say they weren't able to deliver some holiday packages on time due to high volume and bad weather in parts of the country. Mary McCarthy reports.
Christmas is over, but the presents have not yet arrived for some Americans, as United Parcel Service and Federal Express rushed to deliver packages that were supposed to arrive on time for the holiday. UPS said the volume of airmail packages exceeded the capacity of its network in the lead-up to Christmas this year. Much of the demand came from online retailer Amazon.com, which said that customers should receive their orders by Friday and that those with delivery guarantees will get refunds. Meanwhile, FedEx says it handled some 275 million shipments between Thanksgiving and Christmas. It has not given numbers on how many deliveries are arriving late, but did allow some customers to pick up packages at local offices on Christmas Day. In Denver, I'm Mary McCarthy.
And that's the latest feature story news. Malcolm Brown reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Welcome to all three of you, FSN Moscow Bureau Chief Anya Ardaeva, Russia correspondent Tom Barton, and Fiona Hill from the Brookings Institute here in Washington, D.C., an expert and frequent commentator on Russia and the state of the former Soviet Union. Thanks for joining me for our look back at a remarkable year in many ways for Russia and the man at the helm, President Vladimir Putin. And let's start with Syria and the role Russia took in the conflict in terms of UN weapons inspectors entering Syria, instead perhaps of America taking a path of military intervention.
The United States and Russia have agreed that the Syrians must provide the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons and supporting personnel with an immediate and unfettered right to inspect any and all sites in Syria.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry earlier this year outlining the agreement between the U.S. and Russia for the elimination of Syria's chemical weapons. This was quite a diplomatic coup on the part of the Russian leader.
Yeah, of course. It was indeed. I mean, there's analysts and journalists out here in Moscow saying that I think you've got to hand Putin some credit because he did and his foreign ministry were very light-footed, and they did manage to really jump on that sort of throwaway announcement by John Kerry and then build it with the US inclusively into a proposal which is actually perhaps, hopefully, going to see all of Assad's chemical arsenal gone. There's still a big question mark over that, but covering that the way it went, it was a real work of diplomacy there, I think.
Fiona, would you agree with that? I mean, it sort of came out of nowhere, didn't it? And suddenly Russia finds itself on the world stage leading a possible solution to a crisis which has everyone in gridlock almost.
The main precedent that the Russians have set by establishing the resolution of the chemical weapons disposal inside of the United Nations framework is that the future resolution of the ongoing conflict in Syria itself, a civil war, should be only carried out within the framework of the United Nations and the United Nations Security Council, where Russia obviously has a veto. And this is very important because the Russians have been standing on the position for a very long time on Syria and on many other issues that there should be no unilateral intervention by the United States or by any other country. They have come out very strongly against any form of regime change. Obviously, the developments in Libya were very disturbing to Putin personally, as he's made quite clear. This is the summary execution of Gaddafi in the wake of the intervention by the NATO partners in Libya. And they also, the Russians have been at great pains for a very long time to head off any kind of intervention, military intervention or strike against Iran by the United States or Israel in response to Iran's nuclear program. So they want to make sure that in future, any kind of resolution of these kind of thorny problems is within the United Nations, where they can control the situation to some degree. And what we're going to see moving forward on Syria is the push by the Russians to keep the discussions about the conflict, the civil war itself, within the United Nations framework, within this Geneva process that they have also championed, and to make sure that we follow the same rules as we have for the chemical weapons of collaboration, cooperation, and really the United Nations being in the driving seat.
He did not receive a lot of coverage in Russia, unfortunately. I don't think many people out there on the streets knew exactly what was published in that article in the New York Times. Of course, certain people followed that. But I have a question for Fiona. How important is that solution to the Syrian conflict that was found by Russia, the United States and other countries? How important of a precedent does that set for future conflicts of this kind, internal conflicts? Because this, I think it is the first time probably in many, many years when that conflict will be eventually resolved in a peaceful way. Do you think that sets an important precedent and that will help to avoid military interventions in the future?
So although we've had a real success on the chemical weapons of taking those out of the conflict, we haven't had a great deal of progress on resolving the civil war and the brutal slaughter that's taking place there and the huge humanitarian crisis, which is almost unprecedented in recent history. But the precedent has been set of resolving these in a multilateral framework inside the United Nations, because there's now an agreement that the process for resolving the civil war, the ongoing conflict on the ground in Syria, will also be in a context that's framed by the United Nations. And this is really important for other issues that Russia is very concerned about, like dealing with the Iranian nuclear program, where we've got an interim agreement underway, and for other potential conflicts, not just in the Middle East, but elsewhere. I mean, Russia has really made it very clear, as they did in that New York Times piece under Putin's byline, that they do not want to see any kind of unilateral action by the United States or by any constellation of players that forms a repetition of action in Iraq or anywhere else. They've mentioned Libya, obviously, too. We do know, of course, that the Russians have been digging in their feet about Syria for some considerable period now. So in many respects, they are going to have the resolution, the end game in Syria on their terms to some degree as well.
A story that we simply have to get onto. Let's go back to June. A certain Edward Snowden touched down in a Moscow airport. Can you explain to us in Moscow what the reaction was like and what sort of reception the whistleblower, as some people would call him, or fugitive, as the United States government would have it, received?
Yeah, I remember camping out at that airport in the north of Moscow, day in, day out, the hours after hours, and all the journalists were trying to find Snowden. And at times it became really quite comical, that they seek him here, they seek him there sort of story. And obviously for him, though, it probably wasn't half as fun. He was stuck in that airport hotel. And I think that as he sat there, as the weeks ticked by, it became very much a story of two sides, really. This international outcry that Snowden had exposed something very important and that the US and its allies should not be trying to persecute him in the eyes of some. And on the other side, many people in the US feeling that but he was more than just a fugitive, a traitor to the United States that had betrayed their secrets. And Vladimir Putin himself came out and said that asylum would only be given to Snowden if he stopped damaging the United States. And we hear him saying similar things since then as well.
Could you argue that this reaction by Putin, the decision to grant him temporary asylum, maybe changed the perception of the leader, even in the eyes of some civil liberties groups, after offering this man refuge?
Certainly. It definitely played into Putin's popularity on the world stage as someone who is, harboring a man who is sought by the United States, but who is also viewed by many people as not exactly a criminal, but someone who is trying to disclose what some people view as a government abuse of the technology. What is also important is that Edward Snowden has become quite popular in Russia. I think there is no Russian at the moment who would not know that name. I have a question for Fiona. Do you think the U.S. government at the moment has any leverage or any sort of tool it could use to bring Edward Snowden back to the US, or is that not an option anymore?
I don't really see any tools right now that they could use. I guess the most likely scenario is if he tries to move from Russia to somewhere else. I guess Brazil may be in play right now based on some of the news reports. And then the question is whether the United States could interdict him in transit. Otherwise, it looks like Snowden is there to stay in Moscow for now. Obviously, the reverberations of the Snowden affair continue here in the United States, most especially as it affects key relationships for the U.S. with Germany, one of the U.S.'s major allies, and also with Brazil, one of the rising powers, where there's been a really fierce reaction to the revelations. The bigger question, of course, is how this affects policy going forward. Lots of hearings in the U.S. Congress, some discussions, obviously, that feature on the private sector and companies like Microsoft and many others and the implications for them of these revelations. But it hasn't really played out in the United States in ways that, you know, perhaps Edward Snowden and others might have expected, because in many respects, the revelations underscore that no U.S. domestic laws were broken. So there hasn't been the kind of debate that perhaps Snowden might have envisaged internally about privacy and, you know, data protection, which obviously seems to be one of the goals. It's really been outside that you've had that that discussion. And there's been much more focus, obviously, in the press reports about the damage that Snowden has done to U.S. alliances as well as to U.S. reputation, and potentially opening the door for the utilization of the information that he's provided by China, Russia and other countries to step up their own game on espionage.
Can I ask you guys in Moscow, what sort of existence is Edward Snowden living? I mean, is he incognito, or is he actually carving out some sort of a lifestyle there?
I think it would be fair to say that nobody has seen Edward Snowden in person ever since he was in Russia, only briefly during a press conference that he held at the while he was still in the airport with human rights activists. After there was one photo that emerged from that meeting. After that, no one has seen the man, and nobody knows where exactly he is. It was reported that he got a job with the Russian social network Vkontakte, but whether what position he got there and what kind of arrangement he's received is not clear. The lawyer, the Russian lawyer Anatoly Kucherena, who was assisting Snowden in his plight, he said that Edward Snowden was learning Russian, that he's already learned a few phrases, and that he was studying Russian literature. But that's all we know at this point about Edward Snowden's whereabouts.
Perhaps he's hoping to escape to warmer climes. So if Snowden represents a frosty relationship between the US and Russia, an even frostier environment is the Arctic, where we had oil drilling, a protest against oil drilling earlier this year, which resulted in the detention of 30 people. Now, this story has moved on, certainly in recent weeks. But explain to our listeners what happened. Take us back.
Well, it all really jumped off in September when this boat, the Arctic Sunrise, appeared a few miles away from a giant Gazprom oil rig in the Arctic seas there. And it was very, very dramatic pictures and of pictures of the speedboats. Well, we've all seen Greenpeace's sort of tactics before. They're designed to be dramatic. But what was also dramatic was the response of the security forces, who abseiled down from helicopters and held everyone on board. And they were armed with guns at the time as well. And so it was very much a dramatic thing. And there was a large PR campaign going on Greenpeace's part and for their own part from the Russian authorities to try and justify what they were doing as it was happening. And then we got to the criminal charges stage. First of all, piracy, which really took everyone very much by surprise. And then perhaps the Russian authorities realised that they couldn't really be taken seriously holding such a charge, and then reduced it down to hooliganism, which itself is a word that's always in the headlines in Russia these days.
And Fiona, there's now a possibility that thanks to an amnesty from Mr. Putin, these people may be home for Christmas.
Yes, well, maybe. I think we'll have to see about that because, it's entirely possible. But then the question is, will they be allowed to be going back to Russia again? Will there also be restrictions on them for, you know, future travel and activities? But also, I mean, I think Putin's made it very clear that he hopes that they've learned a lesson. I mean, again, this is a signal to everyone else that if you contemplate protests like this on projects that are very important to Russian interests in the Arctic, or be it at the Winter Olympics or the future soccer World Cup, you'd better think twice, because there will be consequences. And Putin, in his recent press set of interviews, underscored this. He said, hopefully these people in future will, you know, be more constructive in their approach to working with the Russian government.
Fiona, you mentioned the Sochi 2014 Winter Games, which are just months away now. Guys, in Moscow, I wonder if you could sort of explain to us how important this is for Putin's legacy.
Oh, it is extremely important. I would think that this is, he views this as probably one of his missions while he's serving as the Russian president. It is now his third term. And he has said repeatedly that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the biggest tragedy for Russia. And of course, people of his generation remember the Olympic Games in Moscow of 1980. And that was a huge event. You know, many people here have a lot of fond memories of that event. And it helped to develop the infrastructure in the city significantly. So this is certainly something that Vladimir Putin is hoping to achieve. He's hoping that he will remain in history of Russia as someone who helped Russia to host Winter Olympic Games in Sochi in 2014.
It's not all rosy when it comes to the Sochi Winter Olympics, apart from being one of Putin's pet projects. Unfortunately, an awful lot has already gone wrong with Sochi. It's massively over budget. There's accusations that workers building the sites have been mistreated, and there's the potential for protests there as well.
There's a chance that these games have already been overshadowed, partly down to Russia's homosexual propaganda law, which was passed earlier this year. Was this a big backfire, do you think, Fiona? Because I'm sure even Vladimir Putin himself has been shocked by the international outrage. And if you could just remind us the details of this law.
Well, this is a piece of legislation that went through the Russian Duma against propaganda, essentially, against the publicity or the publication of materials related to homosexual lifestyle, you know, essentially books, textbooks and other materials that might be used in schools, because it was directed against, I mean, it's really rather a, you know, bizarre idea, the promulgation of information about an alternative sexuality among minors. Where there hasn't exactly been an embrace of same-sex marriage or of the same kind of legislation that we've been pushing through in the United States and in other European countries. Russia is some years behind where other countries have moved and is much more rigid on these kinds of issues. And it wasn't so long ago that homosexuality was completely outlawed in old Soviet legislation. So Putin probably thought that this was quite an easy win on the domestic front. But there's also been some backfiring from his perspective. There have been some really brutal assaults on homosexual figures, public figures, and in Russia itself, people being sacked from their jobs when they've been outed, people being literally brutalized in gang attacks in Russian cities. And Putin's had to, on the domestic front as well, step back and said, hey, you know, this legislation wasn't meant to mean that this was a free-for-all on our citizens who are homosexual, that this is, you know, their right, their freedom. I'm not kind of making a blanket discrimination against them. This is just a very narrow piece of legislation against, you know, basically the dissemination of material. So, you know, he's trying to have the opportunity to push forward this agenda and be able to calibrate it at the same time. And as we know, of course, in all kinds of instances related to these issues, it's a very dangerous line that you have to tread here, because this has really opened up a free-for-all on the domestic front. And, of course, you've had this international backlash, especially ahead of the Olympics, where this is completely contrary to the Olympic spirit. So he's having to tack on this issue both at home and abroad, to try to prevent the Olympics from being overshadowed, but also to roll back these vicious assaults that have been happening at home.
It's a question to all three of you on the Sochi subject, really. The US has snubbed the Winter Games by sending a delegation. I don't think it actually carries any high-ranking White House Obama administration officials in it at all. But what it is peppered with is high-profile gay athletes as a snub, perhaps, to this homosexual propaganda law. Do you think that sort of thing will actually bother the Russian president? Or is it just water off a duck's back?
I think that I think it probably will bother them. They won't. If it does, they certainly will try not to let it show. And I think the message is really there that they want to try and make everyone welcome. Putin said that more than once. Everyone is welcome. And yet, after all of these so-called anti-gay propaganda laws, it's been whipped into such a firestorm now that people cannot stop discussing this idea that Russia is moving backwards while their European neighbours are moving forwards with this kind of legislation. And we've already seen attempts at athletics competitions to try and protest that kind of thing.
And there's been an awful lot of pressure here domestically by many groups on the White House to send some strong signal. Some people are obviously calling for a boycott of the Winter Olympics. I don't think the administration wanted to go that far. And in actual fact, as we know from looking back at the Olympics of 1980 in Moscow and other settings, that boycotts don't always get the message across that you want to get across.
I wanted to talk about another very smooth, swerving move by Vladimir Putin this year, and that was somehow managing to prise Ukraine away from the warm trade embrace of the European Union. This was quite something, considering the protests that we've seen over the last 3 weeks.
Vladimir Putin insisted, though, that this decision to give Ukraine $15 billion in various investments, that it has nothing to do, that's what he insisted on, that it has nothing to do with neither the deal that Ukraine was expected to sign with the European Union nor the protests. He said that Ukraine is the sister, the brother nation of Russia, and because of Russia and Ukraine are being good neighbors, Russia has to help Ukraine, which, and the economy in that country is not doing so well. It's been in a regression in the past 2 years.
Fiona, what does this tell us about what's happening in that region in terms of the relationship between Moscow, Ukraine, and of course the EU?
It actually tells us a number of things. Because of the fact that Ukraine is not just historically and culturally closely tied to Russia, as Putin's been stressing for the best part of the year, but also economically, there is a great deal of overlap with the manufacturing sectors of Ukraine and Russia. There's a lot of Russian investment in Ukraine that obviously is seen as quite strategic. And Putin's been trying to push forward with the expansion of a pre-existing customs union that Russia has with Belarus and with Kazakhstan, two other neighboring countries, and trying to get Ukraine to join in the expectation that this will pull along many of the other former Soviet republics. The other thing that this tells us is that Putin wants to move at all costs to stem these demonstrations in Ukraine. This looks very bad from the Russian perspective. It would be interesting to hear from Annie and Tom how much the Ukrainian demonstrations are getting played out on Russian TV. But Putin has managed to push back the opposition movement from Russia's streets, and seeing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people every day on the main square of Kiev must be rather troubling for Putin, because this does send a signal that, look, people in the region are able to mobilise on their own, and that this could be a real threat to the order. So I think Putin's going to do whatever it takes to help Yanukovych beat back these demonstrations in the fear that this, you know, could set a precedent for further demonstrations in Russia itself.
As Fiona was saying, yeah, there has been a lot of controversy over Russian media coverage of these protests. And unfortunately, many of those observing it from the outside say the coverage is woefully inadequate. And they've even gone as far to say that it's really quite anti-Ukrainian propaganda. One of these broadcasts, live on air, one of the protesters interrupted a live broadcast by a Russian correspondent and handed the presenter on the other end with a fake Oscar for lies and misrepresentation of the situation. And then the reporter went on to push him back off screen and describe how hate-filled all the protesters there were.
And that's where we'll have to leave it. We're out of time, but it just remains for me to say thank you to the three of you. FSN's Moscow Bureau Chief Anya Ardaeva, FSN's Russia correspondent Tom Barton, and Fiona Hill from the Brookings Institute here in Washington, D.C. The special editions of FSN Reports continue tomorrow with a look at the assassination of former Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.